My name is Cindy. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an absolute wreck at this point. You all have achieved a remarkable miracle to have an Al-Anon woman and an AA woman who are sisters speaking. We didn't speak for years. And, here we are speaking. I never have heard her end of it, even a little bit. I was so busy telling her my end of it. You know how we are. And explaining and cleaning up. And I mean, it's awesome to get sober and have people talk about making amends and avoid consistently the one amend that is among the most important to make. Somehow, looking back on it, it seems to me that Sally and I were both born on a very spiritual search. She looked in religions and I looked in drugs, and we've ended up in the same place. It's quite remarkable when you think about it. It's like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Buddha is in motorcycles too, you know. What an incredible experience. I don't even know where to begin. I guess I'll sort of fall back on what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. What it used to be like for me is that I believed somewhere I would find a perfect combination of drugs, the perfect man, and the perfect job to make me happy. What happened is that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and someone like Sandy read that we are affiliated strongly with sex, and I came to believe that I would find the perfect man and the perfect profession to make me happy. And in about 8 days, I will celebrate 11 years of continuous sobriety. What it's like now, after 11 years, is I'm just beginning to realize that I can, if I keep working toward it, accept my personal responsibility for my happiness one day at a time. That's what's happened through 11 years. I'll go into some detail about that progression. I have always been on a spiritual search. I believe alcoholism and drug addiction is a remarkably intense, heroic struggle for God. And we are living proof that it works. The energy in this room, the feeling at this moment, the power that I feel within me is what you have given me, what you have returned to me, what you have restored to me in the last 11 years. The fact that my sister and I have shared in this remarkable journey, and that we also share it now with our Father. There's an interesting research study indicating that the daughters of alcoholic men either marry alcoholics or become alcoholics. As Sally told you, she did the marrying, and I think I got the best end of the deal, actually. I think her journey has been remarkably difficult in a very different way. And if you talk to the two of us independently about our father, you would make a decision that we had two different fathers, because we saw him so differently from the time we were very young. Sally tells me that she was often afraid of him, worried about him, and I saw him as the most exciting, wonderful, thrilling person in the world. When you think about the difference of personal experience, the difference in interpretation, and the ways that we come to express what we truly are. The miracle of sobriety is overwhelming. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1973, and at that time I had an absolutely devastating combination of scotch and morphine that I was trying to get to work for me. I had discovered the trick of working for veterinarians. Many of you have heard that if you have a taste for morphine, go to work for a veterinarian because they use it for their dogs. And if you are very careful, you can learn how to take a couple of cc's of morphine out of the bottle and replace it with a couple of cc's of sterile water and test it periodically to make sure that it continues to work for the dogs. And you're set free from that frightening trip on the streets. I was really not a good junkie. I'm much too cowardly to face that life of insanity. And so I discovered that on the days when the dogs got the best of the morphine, I could patch it up with scotch. And that was the condition of my life in 1973. I had systematically lost everything that was important to me. I had, in 1970, been excused from the university where I was working on a master's degree. I had been declared an unfit mother by the state of Kansas, and I had lost the right to raise my only son. My mother and father had rescued me from that fate and brought me back to Kansas City. Sally uses the word enabling. I really have come to think of it as disabling. The continual rescuing disabled me. And what enabled me was that along with the regular, constant disabling, they enabled me by loving me. I know that makes sense to you, even though it makes no sense. Somehow, we help alcoholics and disable them and continue to help them until we enable them to get sober. I'll talk a little more about that in a minute when I get to my dearest darling teenage son. But, you know, you get to play all the parts in this trip. I have learned the hard way a lot about judgment. I have learned from very personal, intimate, and painful experience that when I judge another person, I create the opportunity to have that experience. When I say, how can she do that? There's a source of energy within me that says, well, we're going to find out. There's nothing quite so efficient as life to help you with your judgment. And I've also found that I no longer need really to pray for humility. Life delivers it regularly. As a matter of fact, the longer I stay sober, the more I realize there really isn't anything to do. There's a lot of being. There's a lot of reporting for duty. There's a lot of just getting up one day at a time and going for it. But there isn't anything to do anymore. Whatever I resist has to persist because I draw it to me. Whatever I fear will happen for me so that I no longer need to fear it. I've had that experience over and over and over. One of the things that I feared most greatly while I was drinking was that I would go crazy. And I did. And I had the opportunity to discover that insanity is not as efficient and as much fun as being drunk. And when you're considering escape routes, And you try drugs, alcohol, and insanity, I think you'll come to a healthy decision that alcohol is by far the best. for me, and I ended my run on alcohol, and that was my movement toward health, because I have a pathological reaction to reality. And that pathological reaction is that I see things the way they are not. I add a lot or subtract a lot, so that when I interpret experiences that come to me, I don't know what's happening. Let me see if I can give you a few examples from my from beginning in 1973, when I began a little bit to pay attention to what was happening to me in a new way. After this disaster of 1970 and the return to alcohol and going to my mother and father's home, and it was about the same time that Sally was recovering from her marriages and I was recovering from a little bout with serum hepatitis and chronic narcotics addiction. And you see, it got us to the same place about that time too. We were both back at Mother's. God love Mother. And there's nothing like having a younger sister who slips around behind the garage to find you on your hands and knees, vomiting your heart out, leaning over and saying, "My dear, God loves you." You understand why I had to make amends, because my response to that was strongly negative. I actually left home at 19 and got married to keep her from helping me. it's probably the most helpful thing she ever did, was to get me on my way to disaster and ruin. At any rate, 1973, January, very cold, very damp. My life had totally dissolved in a series of disasters. And I walked into a restaurant in Kansas City, Missouri. Now, this was on a Friday morning. Pardon me, a Saturday morning. That Friday, the veterinarian for whom I worked had said to me, "The last few days, I'm afraid, have been the last few days. I can no longer afford you. You're interfering dramatically with my efforts to help dogs and cats. And you have fallen below them on the level of people I'm going to help." Veterinarians, by the way, are good rescuers too. And if you look beaten enough, they'll take you in with all the other dogs and cats. And that's what he had done. That's actually how I had gotten the job. And I had told him when he hired me that I was a recovering junkie. And he said, "I can tell by looking at you that you'll never do it again." People have said that to me a lot, and I've always believed it too. It just didn't happen to be true at that point. At any rate, on that Friday evening, he had told me that he didn't think we were going to make it together much longer. So as I closed the clinic, I took with me a bottle of Demerol and a bottle of scotch. And I spent that evening drinking scotch and mainlining Demerol. And nothing happened. For those of you who've had that experience, you know that it is one of unique and incredible horror. To pump into your body any combination of killing, poisonous, lethal drugs, and to suddenly realize that you're not going to die. I hear a lot of people say, "For me to drink is to die." I became aware on that night that I was not going to die. I was going to live that way the rest of my life. I was going to keep waking up day after day, pumping in drugs, pumping out pain. I was not going to get to die, because there was no combination I could put into my body that would kill me. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I knew I was going to live that way, and I couldn't take it another day. Now, the way I know I couldn't take it another day is totally after the fact, because on that Saturday morning I got up and had a couple of drinks and went to this restaurant because I had not eaten for a long time. It was in downtown Kansas City, a place on the plaza where I went very seldom. I walked in and it was absolutely filled with people. And there was one seat available at the counter in that restaurant. And I sat down in that seat next to a stranger and I began to try to eat. I always had a lot of trouble eating in those days. I have a very strong gag reflex, so that all, unless it's liquid, it won't go down. I did the best I could to eat. I gave up. And the man sitting next to me said, "It looks like you've had a hard time." And I said something inconsequential. He said, "I really understand. I'm an alcoholic." I said, "I'm not. How can you understand? I'm an addict." He said, "You smell funny." And I said, I drink to stay off drugs. He said, "Does it work?" And I said, "No." He said, "I have some friends who might be able to help you." And he took me in a very roundabout way to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I began at that point in my life to try to understand what you all were all about. Sally was absolutely accurate when she pointed out that there was something about you I absolutely couldn't stand. I mean, it was something about the happiness and the joy and the laughter and the feeling that went on in meetings. As I look back on it sometimes today, I realize that the reason I hated it so desperately was because I wanted it so much and had come to believe that I could never have it. I was so certain that I had drowned my ability to love, that I would never again be able to care. I knew you cared. I knew I mattered to you. And I thought that meant you were a bunch of drips. That there must be something wrong with you for you to care so much about me. What I realize today is that you did for me the one thing we do so beautifully in this fellowship. You saw only what was left of me. You saw only that little part of me that survived all that destruction and all that damage. You somehow knew it was there, even though I didn't. I didn't have to know, because you did. And as long as you knew, as long as you kept looking at that within me, I began to find the ability to rediscover it. Now, I got sober originally because I fell in love. As a matter of fact, to put it perfectly straight and clear, the man who brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous took me to bed first. Because God, as I understand God, knows what it takes for each of us to get here. He knew how to help me want what you have. Because you see, within each one of us, sometimes carefully hidden, but always there, is the perfect journey, the perfect path to the experiences we desire. I know today that everything I have in my life, I have because I want it. Now, sometimes I don't know how I'm wanting it. Sometimes it's very hard for me to figure out how I'm wanting what feels like chaos and confusion. But I know I have what I want. That's what I have. I create my life. As soon as I begin to accept that responsibility, I begin to find what I understand as true freedom. I always thought freedom was the right to do anything to anybody any way you wanted to. Right? Now I understand that's how you lose your freedom. Today, freedom for me is somehow coming to know what I want just today, asking for it, and seeing if in fact it fits. My problem with asking for what I want is my fear that when I get it, I won't want it. That's how I live an inauthentic life. That's how I get off my center. I have this absolute terror of being wrong. What if I make a mistake? What if I miss the mark? What if I'm a sinner? You know, the original meaning of the word sin is to miss the mark. I am a wonderful sinner. I have missed the mark so regularly. Today I know more about how you hit the target. You shoot with your bow and arrow, and whatever your arrow hits, you call it the target. And I can live my life that way. That's how I get into being, right here, right now. Whatever I hit, that's my target. That's what I want. That's where I'm going. I spent so many years of my life asking questions that had absolutely no answer at the moment. That's what I really am good at if I'm not careful. Asking questions that have no answer at the moment I ask them. You know, I get lost in incredible things like, if only I'd done it differently. I understand guilt today. Guilt serves a very important function in my life. It allows me not to be responsible. Because as long as I'm feeling guilty, I'm saying I should have known then what I know now. I am saying that when I was 30, I should have known what I know now that I'm 43. And what I do is insult that 30-year-old woman, and she doesn't like it. And that's what guilt is for me today. Guilt is insulting my personal experience, therefore totally evading my responsibility for living my life as it comes to me today. I cannot be here and now when I say, if only. If only I'd done it differently. After I'd been sober about 9 months, I again fell in love. It took a series of falling in love for me. It took a series of tall, handsome men to convince me that you all could show me a new way to live. I met a man named Tom. He was the main speaker at a conference, and we absolutely went off together in the wonderful bubble of love and happiness. We ended up in Laguna Beach, California. It was an absolutely incredible journey. We spent 4 years, 4.5 years as man and wife, the perfect AA couple, living and loving and laughing in this fellowship, working with others. We met at a remarkable time for both of us. When we got to Laguna Beach, we needed a place to stay. Tom said, let me call my sponsor. He called a man named Bob E. At that time in Bob's life, things were very difficult, very challenging. And it, as Sally said so beautifully, it was one of those times when we came together in an incredible opportunity to grow. Bob's wife was dying of cancer. I was dying of alcoholism. I lived with 3 sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous and had at that time, in April of 73, what was to be my last slip. And, you know, there are times when that whole experience absolutely overwhelms me because we had gotten Valium for Taylor's pain, the pain of her disease, and it had been ineffective. In fact, it had made her experience much worse. So Bob and I were giving her injections of all kinds of things. There's nothing, if you ever get real sick, get a couple of junkies to help you. We're real good at it. And Taylor was getting sicker and sicker, and I was getting sicker and sicker. And again, I was having an incredibly pathological reaction to stress in my life. I didn't know how to deal with it. I couldn't handle it. I convinced myself of that. In retrospect, I realized I was totally unwilling to handle it. So we put the Valium in a drawer. Bob put it away with the syringes, and my little junky brain said, And within a very short time, I was down in the basement with the vials of Valium and the syringes, mainlining Valium in Laguna Beach, California, with people I loved totally, in a fellowship that I wanted more than anything I've ever wanted in my life. Let me say to you at this moment, on those days when I was in that basement, mainlining that Valium, I wanted sobriety more than I've ever wanted anything in my life. And I was mainlining Valium. Relapsing is part of our disease. It is an experience that will come to all of us in some way, whether it's a relapse back into using drugs, whether it's a relapse back into insanity, whether it's a relapse back into seeking my happiness in another person. This is a relapsing disease. Relapsing is part of recovering. I fall out of it so I can get back into it. I make mistakes so I can correct them. Sobriety, as I understand it, is like riding a bicycle. You constantly correct your errors. You've got to be making the errors or you're not creating sobriety. You fall off this way and that way and this way and that way. My relapsing was a part of my recovery. One of the incredible things that we do in treatment today, and I am in treatment, and if I may get to telling you about that, I may not, but one of the things we do in treatment programs now is look at people who relapse and say, well, they didn't want it. Please believe me when I tell you, in that moment, relapsing in Bobby's basement, I wanted it more than I've ever wanted anything in my life. I know that because I eventually got it. I just didn't know how at that moment. And part of learning how was the relapsing. Was going back to the drugs and back to sobriety and back to the drugs and back to the sobriety. We look at people sometimes in treatment programs and say, well, they just don't want it. That's not true. They want it desperately. I know that from my experience. In treatment, we have failed to learn from our failures. We do really well with people who do well in treatment. We don't do well for people who don't. That's a tragedy. What's wrong with us? In treatment, we suffer the same kind of grandiosity and denial that is a part of alcoholism. Really, think about it. We look at people who come back to Alcoholics Anonymous or come back to treatment 20 times. A man just went through our program who has been in 18 treatment programs before. That man wants it so desperately, and we don't know how to talk to him. We don't recognize something about his brain chemistry, something about his neurological dysfunction. We do not understand that for him, sobriety is excruciating. We don't know how to help. We don't know what to do. And on that day in Bob's basement, I didn't know what to do. So I mainlined Valium. I took away the pain the only way I knew how. Every once in a while, I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, you know, we have three choices, blow our brains out, go crazy, or drink. Whatever you do, don't drink. Think about it. Think about it. We're taking away the healthiest alternative. We really are. Because we know how to help people who drink again. Why are we so afraid of relapsing? We know what to do for somebody who drinks again. We say, come back. We'll love you some more, we'll talk with you some more, we'll open some more. Why are we so afraid of relapsing? When the alternatives are going crazy or blowing your brains out. My brother blew his brains out. I wish he'd had a drink. One more drink might have given us the chance to help him. We really wanted to help him. That's probably part of the problem. Anyway, what happened? Hello. Who said all that? Get out of my soapbox and come back to my story. So, I went to Bob one morning and I said, I've been relapsing down in your basement. Now, I had gone through this conversation in my head a lot of times. What will he say? What will he do? Tom will divorce me. Bob will kick me out. It will be the end. It will all be over. Actually, Tom couldn't have divorced me. We weren't married yet, but it doesn't matter. It would have been the same thing. Because, at any rate, Bob looked at me and said a very simple thing. He said, "Don't you feel better now that you've told somebody?" That's recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't have to judge me. I was doing it. He didn't have to blame me. I was doing it. He didn't have to rub my nose in it. I was doing fine at that. I've never been punished for my defective character. I've always been punished by them. They punish me over and over and over until I give up the guilt, give up the need to blame, give up the need to judge. And I give them up as soon as I can see how they're killing me. And then I take them back and use them again until it becomes so painful that I can give them up again. So Bobby helped me get back to you. No matter what I did in that first year of trying this fellowship, I kept coming back. That's the only secret I know, to keep coming back, to use the relapse to get back with. If you drink again, just come back. One of the things about relapse prevention that we're discovering today is that you can improve the quality of sobriety between relapses, and you can reduce the severity of the consequences of the relapse. That's the creative use of relapsing. Don't blow your brains out. Don't go crazy. Keep coming back. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And we're even beginning to learn it a little bit in treatment. Tom and I had a remarkable journey together for 4.5 years. In the summer of 1977, he came to me one day and he said, "Cindy, I'm going through some changes. I need some time and space away from our relationship. I'm going to move down the street." And he did. And I began to go through my most remarkable surrender. I thought my surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1973 was amazing. I had no idea what was to come, because in the summer of 1977, I was a happily married student living on the beach in Southern California. I had returned to the university after all those years. I was working on my PhD in psychology. I was about to complete it. I was married to the love of my life. We had the perfect marriage. We lived on the beach in the place where God takes vacations, you know. We had the kind of sobriety that you get with Bobby and Chuck C and Clancy I and all those wonderful spiritual gurus who help you discover that you can be sober and absolutely stark staring mad for 20 years. It's wonderful to be in the hotbed of sober insanity, you know. And there's somebody who says that Southern California, the people are just like the geological faults. You know, it's all shifting and changing and blowing up and earthquaking and crazy, and the people are just like that too. And that's why when you're really at the bottom of the barrel, they tip the world, and if you're not rolled down, if you're not screwed down, you roll to Southern California and you run into Bobby E and wake up sober one day. And anyway, to make a long story short, Tom had, unbeknownst to me, while I was busy being a happy student and a happy wife and a happy this and a happy that, Tom had fallen in love with another woman. And I, of course, was the last to know. There's absolutely no reason to concern yourself about finding humility. It will find you. It will walk into your life one day. And I was sitting in my living room, and I was psychologizing. I was just about to finish my PhD, and I was discussing with my friend Patty, you know, Tom is off on this spiritual search. I'm sure he'll find himself. He's just in a kind of a midlife crisis. We were both 37 at that time, and I noticed that the tears were running down Patty's face. I said, "Patty, my God, what's wrong?" She said, "Cindy, don't you know?" I said, "Know what?" She said, "Honey, Tommy's in love with another woman." Now, I had 4.5 years of sobriety at that moment in my life. Anybody could have done it better than I did. I should have been able to do it better, right? I should have been able to walk through that with the dignity and grace of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I would like for you to know that somehow, through the grace of God, as I understand God today, I have the dignity and the grace to absolutely fall apart. I cried for days, weeks. As a matter of fact, after about 2 years, a baby of mine called and she said, "Cindy, how long does it take to get over the loss of a love?" I said, "Well, honey, I don't know. Call me in another couple of years." Now, before I get carried away at some strange tangent, I would like to say that today, I value that experience above all others at this moment in my life. Because at that point in the summer of 1977, my heart broke so it could open. It had to break. It's the only way I could have ever begun to be me. Tommy A. did for me what I could not do for myself. He gave me my freedom. He gave me my responsibility. He gave me the opportunity to be who I am. Because up until that day, that summer, I would have sworn that Tommy A. was responsible for my happiness, my sobriety, my return to the university, my ability to pay attention for more than 5 minutes. That was because of Tom. Tom and I were very good for each other. He wrote 4 books while we were together. I completed my PhD. I believed he did it for me. And he left. He simply left my life. Judging by the severity of my reaction, I was, without any question in my mind, totally addicted to Tommy A. I went through an incredible withdrawal experience. I even had seizures on a weekly basis. Every time it would wash over me that he was gone, it was over, I was alone, I'd go into a seizure. Bob listened to it for hours on the telephone. Hours. Just this endless sorrow, agony, pain. Do you know what it was? My realization that nobody can make me happy because it's my job. It isn't out there. It's in here. It's the most tragic moment of my life. It literally broke me open. I thought I was going to die. And do you know I did? A large part of me died that day. The part of me believed that someday my prince would come. She died a very unhappy death during that experience. Because in a very short period of time, I went from being this happily married student living on the beach to being a single professor living in the desert in Arizona. And I have absolutely no idea what happened. It happened like that. It's like you walk around the corner, you wake up one morning, you go around the corner, and your whole life's different. And you think, what in the world happened? Where did it all go? How did this all happen? In a lot of ways, my life seems to be absolutely none of my business. I seem to have only to show up, to report for duty, to be there, period. To be here now. To be where I am sent. To answer when I'm called. To wake up as much as possible. I know today that my addiction to drugs, to men, to something outside of me, is my effort to be unconscious. And my recovery, my beginning freedom from drugs and from men and from something out there, is my journey into consciousness. And there are days when I don't want to be conscious. There are days when I have a pathological response to reality as I see it on that day. And what I can change today is how I see it. The way I see it today is that it's always and in every way perfect. Now, it's very hard to see it perfect when it's not. It's very hard to make a case for the fact that I am every day, no matter what, perfectly me, because a lot of times I want to be perfectly someone else or somewhere else. I give anything to change who and what I am. And like Sally said, that's not what it's all about. It is not to change who and what I am. It is, as I understand it today, to be who and what I am. To be, to the best of my ability, the most perfect expression I can be of what I am today. I thought that was supposed to happen through other people. I've been for a long time a people pleaser. I've just begun to have some insight into what happens when I'm a people pleaser. When I do the best I can to say what I think you want me to, when I do the best I can to be what I think you want me to be, do you know that all of a sudden I realize when you like what I'm trying to be, whatever you like is not me? You're liking something I've created. And you can't like me because you can't know me, because I haven't let you know me. And most of all, I want to please you. And in my effort to please you, I lose me. And in that loss, that part of me that I've insulted and degraded and put down screams and fights and struggles for understanding. My challenge today is to do the best I can to know who I am, be who I am, and express who I am. And it's a very difficult task because I keep wanting you to tell me. I keep wanting you to help define who I am, and you don't know. I do. I'm the only one who knows. One of the ways I protect myself from self-knowledge is to say, I don't know. I prevent a lot of opportunity and a lot of experience when I say, I don't know. This is the strangest talk I've ever heard. Does this seem like a strange talk to you? It's almost time to quit, and I haven't even started. Am I divorced from Tom? Yes, yes, I'm divorced from Tom. Right. And I'm in the desert, right? I long enough in sobriety, you will come to a point where all your experience makes a lot of sense. You wake up one morning and say, oh, I know why I did that. Because I woke up one morning in the desert, and after 18 years of drug addiction and alcoholism and 15 years of education, I was a professor at the University of Arizona teaching people how to work with drunken junkies. And you see, I had to be a junkie, I had to be a drunk, and I had to have all that education. I spent from the September of 1959 until July of 1977 as a student in college. That's 18 years in college. And I'd like to tell you, some people think that that's a dramatic achievement. Not true. Going to college is one thing I really know how to do. If you'll give me a book and give me some idea how you want me to think about it, I'll be so grateful to you. And I'll do everything I can to give it back to you the way you want it. And you see, we have an education system that does that to people these days. I mean, I now have a PhD in psychology. In our society, that's a reward for rigid thinking. Must be a few PhDs in the audience. large portion of the years since I got that PhD trying to undo the damage I've done. I would like more than anything in the world to have more immediate access to my intuition, but my intellection won't allow it. I have to think about it first. I have to think about what it feels like. Now, when you filter what you feel through what you think, you're not getting much. And I spend a lot of my time trying to figure out what I feel. Do you hear what I'm doing? Trying to figure out what I feel. No wonder I feel so strange sometimes. It's going through a filter that it doesn't have to go through, but I can't break the cycle. I have this cycle going. I taught for 6 years at the University of Arizona, a wonderful thing for me to do for 6 years of my life. I achieved one of my fondest dreams, to be a professor in a university, to teach people something I really had experienced in my heart and my mind. And I want you to know it was among the greatest disillusions I ever experienced. Universities are appalling places. I mean, please believe me when I tell you I love them. I'd go back in a minute if they give me another degree. They just don't have any more for me. But if I just stand back for 1 minute and take a look at what we do to people in universities, how we take these incredible creative minds that are reaching out, grasping, wanting, and we put them in little boxes with little strings on them, and we say, this is your area of expertise. Well, you know, we try to turn people out like automatons with specialties, and I mean, we're like men who've lost their legs, you know? I don't think we're ever going to grow new ones. I don't think we know what they are anymore. And I'm not talking about just talking about the need to be right, the need to have a specialty, the need to compete, the need to achieve, the need to separate more and more me from who I am. It's absolutely incredible, the society we have created so that we can transcend it. I mean, that's my hope, that we've put it together this way so the day will come when we look at it and say, God damn, that's terrible. We've created a technology that's using us. We don't know how to use it. We have machines in the hospital that nobody knows what to do with. They're sitting around, people saying, what are we going to do with that? Holly said last night on the way here as we were talking about it, she said, you know what people keep forgetting? They keep forgetting to ask God what to do with it. That's right. We keep forgetting to ask God what to do with this technology that's outstripping us, outgrowing us. So my disillusion at the university was dramatic and painful, and I went through a lot of realizations that I had what I wanted and I just didn't want it anymore. Ram Dass says it wonderfully, if you pray for a pink Cadillac, it's okay to pray for a pink Cadillac. It's okay to pray for specific things. Pray for that pink Cadillac. Just be aware that when you get it, the person who wanted the pink Cadillac might not be there anymore. That's sort of the way it happens. I pray for specific things, and I get them, and I think, now, who wanted this? Yeah. You know? That's why I'm more and more comfortable praying only for the knowledge of God's will for me and the courage to carry it out. I only did half of that for a long time. I prayed for the knowledge of God's will, and then I wondered where in the world it was. Instead of realizing that the moment I pray for the knowledge of God's will, that's what I have for the rest of the day, because God's will and my will are the same. My will often gets me into things. God's will always gets me out. We work together, hand in hand. He is closer than hands and feet. What does that mean to you? That means he and I are one. You and I are one. It's an absolutely incredible experience to feel that power pick me up by the nape of the neck and say, honey, we're going to the desert. Now we're going into that university you wanted so much. Now you're going to see that it wasn't what you thought. Now you're going to get this offer here. Now you're going to get that. What happened is that in the midst of this experience in the desert in 1980, I had often said, one thing I'm never going to do in sobriety is fool around with a married man. How can they do that? Those bad girls fooling around with those married men that if they did drunk, they should straighten up now that they're sober, live the right kind of life, da 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 da. Guess what? I fell smack dab in love with a married man. Of course, I created that opportunity. It was absolutely necessary that it happened. I had judged too many people too harshly not to have the opportunity to have that experience. A man came into my life. We worked together for a year on a program committee, had a very wonderful working platonic relationship. At the end of the year, in one of those blazes of glory, I mean, I never fall in love easily. It's always real hard. And it was a very difficult time for both of us. We both had 7 years of sobriety at that point. He was very married. His wife had just had a baby. She was a perfect Al-Anon. She took care of us. She calmed us down when we got carried away with the excitement of things. It was a very painful experience for both of us. We found out who loved us. We found out who judged us. We found out who cared about what we were. And we found out who couldn't handle what they are. We found out a lot of things during that experience. He and I have together today a daily opportunity to grow. Because last summer, it always seems to be a phone call, you know? And the telephone rang, and the man who had helped me get back into the university and complete my PhD, get back out into the world, was on the telephone, and he said, "Cindy, how would you feel about coming back to Southern California?" I said, "Well, what do you have in mind?" He said, "Well, we're putting together a new concept in the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction. And we would like for you to join us in our efforts to put this thing together." Now, it's interesting in looking back on that, anybody in the universe could have called but this one particular man, and they could have called from any place else in the world other than Southern California, and I wouldn't have been interested. But it came together in a way that I could not refuse. That's how life happens for me. I have been teaching people for 6 years how to work in alcoholism and drug treatment. I didn't know what I was talking about. I taught them a lot of ideas, a lot of theories, a lot of research projects. And all of a sudden, one day, the telephone rang, and God, as I understand, God said, "Honey, it's time to stop reading about how you ride a bicycle. You are now going to get on one." And I came to Southern California, and I became involved in the treatment of drug addiction and alcoholism. It is like getting on a bicycle after all those years of reading about it. I keep falling over. I keep correcting my errors. I keep looking at what we're doing in treatment and asking why we're doing it. And if it doesn't work as often as it doesn't work, why don't we do something else? Why do we keep asking questions, getting the same answers, and never examining what we're doing? How come we in treatment seem to suffer so dramatically from the disease of addiction? We are so addicted to what we think we're doing that we can't see the forest for the trees. What we keep trying to do in treatment is to do what Alcoholics Anonymous does, and we can't do that in treatment. I believe more today than I ever have before that Alcoholics Anonymous does what it does perfectly. It cannot be reproduced. It cannot be done in a 30-day treatment program. I think it's a tragedy that people believe they work the first 5 steps in a 30-day treatment program. At Genesis, we do not work the steps. We do our best in 30 days to get people ready to work the steps. That's all we do. And I believe more and more every day that we can facilitate the journey into Alcoholics Anonymous better in treatment if we ever figure out what to do. If we ever figure out how to help people open up to what is available in this fellowship, if we ever figure out how to have people listen the way Sally listened when she walked in, to the love and the joy and to want that instead of hating it, and to feel the belonging instead of fighting it. The more I learn about alcoholism and drug addiction, the less I know for sure. It's an absolutely remarkable phenomenon, and to me it has something to do with my not wanting to know myself, my not wanting to accept my responsibility, my not wanting to be who and what I am, always having some dream of where I ought to go and what I ought to do and what I ought to be, and missing daily who I am. Somehow in 28 days, we do the best we can at Genesis to help people simply want to be. It's a terrible job. It's a tough job. You all know how hard it is to simply want to be. That's the last thing I wanted the day I got sober. I didn't want to be anymore. How can we help people want to be? Just to be. I heard an amazing anecdote about a conference of treatment professionals who were talking about their concepts of treatment, and one person attending the conference was a program director from the Soviet Union. And all these treatment directors are sitting around talking about, they come into our program, they get one shot at it, if they relapse, they can't come back for 6 months. Another program director said, we bring them in, if they relapse, they can come back two times. If they relapse the third time, that's it. We have nothing more to do with them. They just don't want what we have. Another program director said, we let them come back once, then they can't come back for a year. Serves them right. The program director from the Soviet Union stood up and he said, we have a very different view of alcoholism in Russia. We believe it's a disease. Person who continues to relapse. We're trying to discover what kind of brain chemistry, what kind of neurological dysfunction, what kind of metabolic disorder is going on within that person that makes it impossible for them to take sobriety one day at a time. As a matter of fact, he says, we have facilities for people who are terminally ill with alcoholism. We know they'll never get sober, and we take care of them until they die. How about that? We have nothing like that. We turn our chronic relapsers over to other folks. The funny farm, the nursing homes, Skid Row. We don't want it if they don't want what we have. We don't want anything to do with them. We turn them out. And we say, they didn't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. They can't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. They're sick. They don't understand. They can't listen. They can't feel what we feel. They can't hear what we hear. They're too sick. And we don't see them as sick. We see them as bad. Bad boy. You won't listen. You won't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. What's wrong with you? He's dying. He's desperate. He wants more than anything in the world a life of sobriety, and he doesn't know how to get it. There is no such thing as a hopeless alcoholic. No such thing. We feel hopeless because we don't know what to do for them. There are people who have survived as many as 40 aversive treatments, gone through vomit therapy 40 times, and they keep coming back. And we look at them and say, they don't want what we have. Isn't that a remarkable kind of grandiosity? I mean, we're really suffering from our disease in treatment. We can't admit our failure. We can't learn from our failure. We can't look at ourselves with clear, open eyes and say, how can we do it differently? How can we open up to the person who still suffers? How can I be truly available when anyone, anywhere, reaches out? That's what I want. I want to be there. I don't want to say, he's got to do it my way. I don't want to say, what's wrong with him? I want to ask myself how I can be of service. What I have learned in almost 11 years of sobriety is sort of a switch on the phrase, there but for the grace of God go I. You all heard that one? I understand it a little bit differently today. I know that there, because of the grace of God, go I. As long as someone is drunk and suffering, so am I. I am clean and sober almost 11 years. And there are people drunk and suffering who can have what we have, who can want what we have, who can be what we are. Our challenge is to be there, to be more what we are. Because as long as they're suffering, so am I. You and I really are one. God really did create all of us at once. We are really simply pieces of a puzzle that fit together. And as long as we struggle against each other, we can't come together. We can't find the answer. I swear, if I keep working at it, I will understand more and more clearly how I go about separating myself. And once I see how I separate myself, I can then see the journey back to you, back to oneness and unity, back to being a part of what you are, which is what I am. You are, as a matter of fact, my mirror. What I think of you is what I think of myself. What I say about you is what I am saying about myself. What I judge in you is what I'm judging in myself. When I can use you to learn about me, we are free to be together. My relationship with Bart today is that kind of a relationship. We use each other as a mirror. We are learning a little more how to talk to each other. Simple example is, I have learned how to say to him, I'm happy and I'm with you. I used to say, you make me happy. Do you realize that when I say to you, you make me happy, I'm making a very aggressive statement? Because what I'm really saying is, you make me happy and you better, you son of a bitch. What I'm doing when I say, you make me happy, is tying you to me. I'm infringing on your freedom and giving up mine. I'm disempowering myself. I'm giving you the responsibility for my happiness. And God, as I understand, God keeps giving it back to me. He keeps saying, honey, they're not going to make you happy because it's your job. Here's your job back. Take your job back. Learn that you have everything you've ever wanted. You are everything you've ever been. You're every place you ever wanted to be. You have what you want. That's why you have it. And how are you wanting what you have? Today, my life was full of confusion and conflict and chaos because of this incredible job in this new treatment program. I mean, it's absolutely, some of you I know understand what it's like to have, you know, to have the challenge of creating a therapeutic environment for people who really want to get clean and sober and have a therapy team that's at each other's throats. I mean, you know, how are you going to create a healthy environment when you can't stand the sight of each other? And it's absolutely phenomenal. I have a feeling that it's like total confusion in my life has always been. When I look back on it and remember and reflect just for a minute, total confusion has always been the psychic predecessor to all real important change. It gets real dark before it's light. It feels very confusing in my life today. I have one wonderful thread that is going with me now as I go with it, and that's my relationship with this beautiful man. It keeps I stay on target. I am more able to stay centered because he and I are in it together. But everything else has fallen apart again. Here I am. Anybody should be better by now, right? 11 years almost. Anybody should be able to say, one day at a time, easy does it. I keep struggling. I keep fighting it. I keep wrestling with, what am I doing and why am I doing it? And I keep missing just doing it. I keep forgetting that I can just wake up every morning, report for duty, go with it. If you can't fight and you can't flee, flow. All those wonderful, simple things that make life just flow along. And I keep digging in my heels and struggling and fighting. And I absolutely believe that that's the only thing I can do today. That's what I know to do, so that's how I'm doing it. I've always done the best I can, always. At any given moment in my life, I was always doing my best. God loved me when I drank. God loved me when I shot morphine. God loves me today. God, as I understand God, is just like that source of electricity. And I'm like a little light bulb. That source of electricity is available to me all day. All I have to do is plug into it. I get to choose if I want to be a 40-watt bulb, a 3-watt night light. I get to choose how much energy I want to use. I somehow have the total freedom and the full responsibility of being my light bulb. Plugging into that energy, it has never been kept from me. It is available to me always, in all ways. There's absolutely nothing unavailable to me. I'm the only one who limits my life today. I'm the only one who limits my vision. I'm the only one who says I'll only take this much and this long, when I could have it all if I really wanted it. My challenge today is to know more and more what I want. The more clearly I can focus my energy and attention on what I want today, the more clearly I see what you want. I always thought it was the other way around. I always thought I had to figure out what you wanted so I could decide what I want. That's not it. Today, it's absolutely essential that I know right here, right now, what I want. Giving myself the right to change, to grow, to be different in 10 minutes than I am right now. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most remarkable journey I have ever undertaken. I know today it will continue with me no matter where I go. It's a part of my heart, a part of my soul. Our father joined us on this journey when my brother took his life in 1979. My dad got sober, and this past March he celebrated 5 years. It's one of those experiences in life that teaches me that every ending is a new beginning. It's so hard to look for the beginning when you're in the midst of the ending. Endings are so painful because I'm so attached to the way I want things to be. And I forget to realize that things change. Sally and I prayed for the knowledge of God's will for our brother for a long, long time. And when the knowledge of that will came, we had a very hard time accepting it. We wanted to say, no thanks, not this way. My brother did it his way. He did achieve God's grace, just not the way I wanted. And that's how I keep struggling. I keep struggling and fighting and saying, I want your will, Father, but not this way. My challenge today is to take it as it comes, to go for it, to take a risk, to risk more and more the challenge of being me, whoever that turns out to be. Standing here today, I don't know whether to make a decision or not make a decision, both of which are quite interesting decisions. I don't know whether to stay with my job or leave my job. I don't know whether to keep fighting with treatment and see if somewhere there's a light at the end of the tunnel, or if that light at the end of the tunnel is in fact a locomotive. And I can't tell sometimes if I'm pounding my head on the wall or the wall is pounding its head on me. I get totally confused and struggle with that confusion. And always, in the midst of all of it, there's a quiet place inside of me that I know is the voice of God. And the way I know it's the voice of God is because it is always very quiet. The voice of my ego is very loud. It always answers first. The voice of God is very quiet and very gentle. And it says, honey, you have the right to make every mistake you can think of, to go in every direction you want to go, to try it in every way you can come up with. I will love you no matter what, no matter how long it takes. You have eternity today. You have the one eternal moment, which is now. You can do it as long as you want, because I'm doing it with you, one day at a time. This fellowship has brought our family into a new kind of relationship. It has given me a new relationship with myself. We have one member of our family suffering brilliantly right now, my wonderful son, who is 20 years old yesterday. That means he's an Aries. That means he's going to do it until he drops. That means he'll do it the way I did it, with the blood running out of his fingers. You see, one of the things that has occurred to me, if I could help anybody in the world that I really wanted to help in the way I want to help them, I would help my son. I would, as a matter of fact, lock him in a closet and keep him there until he's 25 years old and has two kids and a job in a bank. I would, left to my own devices, prevent all of his suffering. Now, I have just spent approximately an hour talking to you about the value of my suffering, but I can turn right around, look at my son, and try to prevent his. Isn't that incredible? Now, you know, God, as I understand God beautifully today, says, sorry, honey, it's not your job, it's his. Because you see, now that I see that my happiness is my job, I see that his unhappiness is his job, not mine. It's real hard to get that. I mean, if you can survive these days, the journey of a teenage son, you can make it through almost anything. There are hardly anything, there are very few things that are more difficult than living with a teenager that I've ever experienced, especially one that looks so much like you. Especially when you look at the mirror every morning and it says, hang it your ear, Mom. And it's excruciating. And it's one of the places where I learn how to get in touch with my guilt. That guilt that I mentioned earlier that prevents me from being a responsible, participating member of today. I can look at my son and I can say, it's all my fault. Talk about grandiosity. Whoa. Because somehow I would take God's job and say, I know what's best for that child. He should not drink and he should not use drugs. Now, when I say my son should not drink and my son should not use drugs, I am insulting my own journey with drugs and alcohol. Therefore, I'm insulting his journey. Isn't it interesting that I can teach people how to do it? I can talk to people about how to do it. When it comes my turn to do it, I don't know how. That's when faith comes in very handy. With all of my doubt, with all of my questions, I know the quality of my faith. Since I have doubt, I have faith. Faith without doubt is not faith. It's something else. Just like courage without fear is not courage. I thought I didn't know how to be courageous. I didn't know that one of the things that goes with you when you have courage is lots of fear. Otherwise, you're insane or ignorant. Because true courage is accompanied by great fear. true faith is accompanied by a lot of doubt. I have a lot of faith. I have a lot of courage. I have a lot of doubt. I have a lot of fear. I fear greatly for my son. I haven't heard from him for a long time, and the last time I heard from him was a call from Germany, where he's in the army, telling me that he had gotten busted for being drunk on duty. So, that's the last I heard, 3 months ago. You know, when you have a terminal case of motherhood, as I do, you can create a lot of experiences in 3 months of not hearing from him. I have created many scenarios about what's happening to him. And Bart keeps reminding me that if he were dead, I'd know. Otherwise, I won't. I must assume, therefore, that he's somewhere living. And he's somewhere doing what he has to do. For me today to recognize that my son is on a perfect journey is to acknowledge my perfect journey. To say to you today that I would not undrink one drink, I would not unshoot one fix, I would not undo one day, I would not unbreak all my broken hearts, I would not change anything today. I would not go back into my life and remove 1 minute, because what if I remove the minute that made today possible? That might happen, you know. Because if you gave me the choice of what to undo, I might undo today. And I wouldn't take anything for what I have today. I would not trade one step of my journey for what I have today. My fear for my son is truly my fear for myself. And that's okay. I understand that my prayer that he survive his lessons is a very selfish prayer, because I don't want to lose him. That's okay. I don't have to want to lose him. I simply share his journey today to the best of my ability. That's all that is for me to do. He came through me. He's not of me. He's not mine to fix. Thank God that God has taken care of that. Just as you all took care of me, just as you saw what was left, gave it new life, gave it new freedom, each day in this remarkable journey. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what this trip is all about. I love it. I fear it. I doubt it. I cry over it. I beg for understanding. I try to accept totally that I do not understand, and that's okay. If I'm ever going to, wonderful. If not, okay. I'm just going to show up. I'm just going to do it one day at a time with you. The journey into me being with you, into you asking me to come here for some strange reason and be here now with you in what we have together today. We are remarkable reflections of each other. I see in you all of my hope, all of my fear, all of the promise of my future. Thank you for asking me to share.